Thank you all for coming this morning. My name is Courtney Mitchell. I'm one of the organizers. I am pleased to introduce today's first keynote speaker, a voice of experienced and impassioned critique of the society we currently live in. A Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Chris Hedges has published 12 books that have taken on virtually everyone. Liberals, atheists, the extreme Christian right wing, media literacy, and education. He has reported on war as a foreign correspondent from 50 countries and has worked for esteemed media outlets such as the New York Times, the Christian Science Monitor, and National Public Radio. He's the recipient of Amnesty International's Global Award for Human Rights and has twice won Los Angeles Press Club's Online Journalist of the Year. You can find his column on Mondays on Truthdig, and his dedication to speaking the truth about the necessity for revolutionary change is the reason why we chose his voice to narrate the promotional video for this year's conference. Please join me in welcoming Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Courtney. I sat down with my notes this morning, which I had prepared when I was in Princeton, and as I, with my red pen, sort of went through them, decided what had already been covered and what this audience was clearly already literate about. And by the time I finished, there wasn't much of a talk left. I came prepared to deliver a 101 lecture and walked into a graduate seminar, which is great. There is a point that I want to talk about and focus on, 2 points. The first being that we got here by design. David Noble wrote a very fine book about this called America by Design. We didn't just stumble here by accident. I had written a book before Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which I did with the great cartoonist Joe Sacco, called Death of Liberal Class. And that book was originally done for a publisher, a large publisher in New York, Knopf. And when I turned in, Derek's probably had this experience, when I turned in the manuscript, the editors at Knopf read it and hated it and offered to assign an editor to take out what they called all the negativity. And then Knopf would be happy to publish it. Well, you can imagine how that went down. So I called Nation Books, and you get half of your advance up front. I said, just give them what they've already paid me. You can have the book. And in that kind of transformation, it focused primarily on the press and didn't have that original title. I realized that it wasn't just the press, which I come out of, that had collapsed as a liberal institution, but all of the pillars of the liberal society. Of course, the Democratic Party, the liberal church, which I come out of, I graduated from seminary, culture, which has been completely commercialized and trivialized, labor, the labor movements, which have been destroyed, and that search for what happened, the origins of those establishments that once made piecemeal and incremental reform possible, led me back to World War I. Which I think was, on many levels, maybe the most seminal and dangerous moment in modern human history. Of course, that began the whole process of industrial warfare. You created weapon systems whereby hundreds, at times thousands, of people could lose their lives in an instant without ever seeing their attackers. You created total war in terms of mobilizing whole economies. But it also, and with it, and I think that, this is what Derek's point was on this panel before I came out here, this kind of sociopathology manifests itself in many ways throughout the society. And as Randolph Bourne wrote, war is the health of the state. And so... on the eve of World War I in this country, we had numerous radical, populist, movements that had finally cornered the capitalist power elites. The labor wars in the United States were the bloodiest labor wars in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers were murdered, and thousands were injured, and many thousands, tens of thousands more, were blacklisted and could never work at all. You saw the rise of anarchist, communist, socialist, anarcho-syndicalist movements, great radical writers, whether Jane Addams, organizers, the settlement houses, Appeal to Reason, which was a socialist journal with the fourth highest circulation in the country, the masses. All of these people had begun at great cost to transform the society. And when Wilson finally pushed us into war, and there was heavy pressure, of course, on Wilson to go into war, with the collapse of the Russian front and the ability of Germany to move 51 divisions over to the Western Front, where they could mount an offensive, which they did, of course, that next summer, which nearly destroyed the Allied forces. The bankers on Wall Street had lent huge sums of money to the British and the French, and if the British and French did not win the war, those sums would never be paid back. So Wilson, who had run on a campaign slogan, "He kept us out of the war," in 1916, ends up pushing us into the war. And there's a debate. I went into the Princeton University archives to actually read the debate that was taking place in the White House between Wilson and Walter Lippmann and Arthur Boulard and other intellectuals who were trying to decide whether, because the country that there was no popular support for the war at all. Indeed, you know, when Wilson went to the Capitol to declare war, he had to be protected by an entire troop of cavalry for fear of anarchist bombs. And Wilson wanted to impose the sedition and the Espionage Act, which Obama has now abused 8 times to shut down whistleblowers, to essentially, through censorship and through the threat of imprisonment, criminalize dissent. And Lippmann and Boulard and others argued that by employing the systems of modern mass propaganda, the understanding of crowd psychology pioneered by figures like Le Bon, Trotter, and of course Sigmund Freud, you could essentially create emotional manipulation to get the masses to call for their own enslavement. And Lippmann won. And, you know, you should read Public Opinion, which Lippmann wrote after the war, which is this kind of very dark blueprint. It's where Chomsky and Herman get that term, manufacturing consent. That's from Lippmann. And so they create the first system of modern mass propaganda, which, of course, is with us today. And this system understands, because of the studies by Le Bon, Trotter, and others, that people are not moved by fact or reason. They're moved by the skillful manipulation of emotion. And it's quite disheartening to read those stalwart figures like Jane Addams or Randolph Bourne or Eugene V. Debs who held fast to that moral imperative against wartime capitalism and exploitation and war itself, war essentially driven by the concerns of Wall Street, not by the national security interests of the United States. And one of the things that all of those writers despair about is how not only how easily the masses have been seduced, but how easily the intellectual class has been seduced. Jane Addams being booed off of a stage in Carnegie Hall, Eugene V. Debs finally being imprisoned for several years for calling people not to resist the draft, which Wilson had to impose 30 days after declaration of war. And what happened is that, and of course they created a film division. They were Hollywood, not surprisingly, was churning out all sorts of potboilers like the Kaiser, the Butcher of Berlin. Its own news division, which created, all publications had to support the war. Appeal to Reason did in their editorial page. The masses didn't, and shut down until after the war. And by the end of the war, all of those mechanisms, that system of mass propaganda, use of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, which were reserved for those recalcitrant radicals who refused to conform, became part of the fabric of American society. Once World War II was over, the dreaded Hun was almost instantly replaced with a dreaded Red. The systems of mass propaganda, the Committee for Public Information, led by George Creel, had been a muckraking journalist who oversaw the propaganda machine, ended his career, by the way, working for Nixon and McCarthy in the McCarthy hearings, transferred to Madison Avenue and began working on behalf of corporations. And those corporations used this system of propaganda to instill the cult of the self, the hedonism of consumer society, to foster the kinds of anxieties which consumer society essentially needs to instill within a population in order to generate profit. And they upended traditional values, self-effacement, thrift. And I think oftentimes when we talk about American values, what we're really talking about are corporate values that have been imposed upon us. They then used the harsher forms of control, the Sedition and the Espionage Act. They shut down Appeal to Reason. They shut down the masses. That's when Berkman and Emma Goldman got deported. That's the Palmer raids. And you began, there's a writer who writes about this period that I like very much, who's not read as much as he should be. He's a brilliant writer, Dwight MacDonald. He said that two things happened at the end of the war. And one was that we created what he calls a psychosis of permanent war through anti-communism and now through the fear of the war on terror. And he said that psychosis of permanent war was not understood or envisioned by any of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Marx. And essentially, through the manipulation of fear and the psychosis of permanent war, you can destroy all of those mechanisms that created an opening within a democratic society. I teach in a prison. And if you teach in a prison, it's exactly the opposite of teaching in a university where, if you teach in a university, you try and write some pithy course description to entice undergraduates to take your course. If you write a description for a course you want to teach in a prison, you have to get it through a prison administration, so it has to be as banal as possible. And I wrote one which got passed saying I wanted to teach American history and our Constitution and our Founding Fathers, which they approved. And then when I got into the prison classroom, I gave every one of my students a copy of Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States. Now, that's an extremely important book. It's also moving because there are African-American students who've never been taught their own history. And I would be giving talks out of that book. And Zinn is very cognizant throughout the book of the experience and the suffering of African-Americans in American society. And I would hear my students go, Damn, we've been lied to. But Zinn understood that all of the openings in American democracy were driven by populist and radical movements that never achieve formal positions of power. And this, I think, echoes Karl Popper's brilliant point in The Open Society and Its Enemies, where he says, the question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question. Most people, Popper writes, who are attracted to power are at best mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is how do you make the power elite frightened of you? That's the question. And that's what we've forgotten on the left. It's not our job to take power. Power's the problem. And all of these movements, whether it was the abolitionist movement, the suffragists, the labor movement, and maybe the last great movement, the civil rights movement, none of these movements achieved power. And yet you could argue that until he was assassinated in Memphis in April of 1968, the most powerful political figure in the United States was Martin Luther King. And that's what we have to reclaim. What happened is that, and this goes to Marx, that capitalism, unfettered, unregulated capitalism, and Marx calls it a revolutionary force, that unfettered, unregulated capitalism has built within it a self-annihilistic quality because it has no internal restraints, and many speakers have dealt with this issue yesterday and today. It will exploit, it will commodify everything, human beings, the natural world, until exhaustion or collapse, so that 40% of the summer Arctic sea ice melts, and fossil fuel companies like Shell look at it, the death throes of our planet, as a business opportunity. And the check on unfettered, unregulated capitalism were these radical populist movements. And the last great sort of contribution to the check on capitalism came with the breakdown of capitalism in the 1930s and the New Deal, which would have never happened without the Progressive Party and all of the Wobblies and the old CIO and everyone else. And it's interesting that Roosevelt was very cognizant of what he was doing and wrote afterwards that his greatest achievement was that he saved capitalism. Because with the breakdown of capitalism, he created mechanisms. And that's, Chomsky writes that the liberal class acts as a kind of safety valve. So you regulate the system by creating the public works programs and Social Security to keep capitalism afloat. But none of that happens without these radical forces putting pressure on the center of power and making the liberal class, which was never designed to be the left, respond. And I don't have time to give you Chomsky's. I wrote this book, Death of the Liberal Class, and I told Noam I should have put you as a co-author because it's Chomsky's understanding that the liberal class, a functioning liberal class, is a vital element to maintaining democratic capitalism. But it's broken, and it's broken because there's no pressure put on it. And what we have seen is the rise of this faux liberalism, embodied in particular by Bill Clinton, who speaks, like Obama, in that feel-your-pain language, and yet assiduously serves corporate interests. So it's under Clinton that you get NAFTA, the greatest betrayal of the working class since the Taft-Hartley Act of 1948. You get the destruction of our welfare system, and under our old welfare system, 70% of the recipients were children. You get the deregulation of the FCC, so roughly six corporations now control the airwaves. 90%+ of all Americans get information that are filtered through six mega corporations: Disney, Clear Channel, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp. You get the omnibus bill, the crime bill of 1994, which sees the explosion of our prison system. This understanding war, like mass incarceration, is a business. The bodies of poor people of color in our internal colonies, as Malcolm X called them, are worth nothing on the street. Our surplus labor, put them behind cages, in cages, and they can generate $40,000 or $50,000 a year in profit for phone companies, laundry companies, guard companies, the private prison industrial complex. And then, of course, the destruction of Glass-Steagall, which had separated commercial and investment banks, which precipitated the financial meltdown. But Clinton understood that by doing corporate bidding, he would get corporate money, which he did. So when Obama actually ran in 2008, he got more corporate funds than the candidate he was running against. And that kind of faux liberalism is something that I saw in Yugoslavia. Well, because what it does is, in essence, create political paralysis. You have a self-identified liberal elite which cannot respond rationally to the problems, unlike Roosevelt and the New Deal. It cannot, in fact, respond at all. I mean, I was, as many of you were, involved in the Occupy movement, and a rational response by a functioning liberal elite to the Occupy movement would have been a moratorium on foreclosures and bank repossessions, a massive jobs program, particularly targeted at people under the age of 25, a rational public option healthcare system instead of this insane, defective product that we're now all forced to buy that feed corporate profits. And yet none of that happened. The state responded by physically eradicating the Occupy encampments around the country. And that's a very dangerous sign because it shows that the state is capable of speaking only in one language. And that's the language of force and coercion. We have now amassed the most, and I covered the Stasi state in East Germany, we have amassed the most potent security and surveillance apparatus in human history. We are the most eavesdropped, monitored, filmed population on the planet. When you live under a system of wholesale surveillance, you can no longer use the word liberty. When you are watched 24 hours a day by your government, that is the relationship between a master and a slave. Now, the state understands very well what's coming. And they are preparing in a way that certainly everyone in this room, I think, has a grasp of what's coming and is attempting to prepare, but which the wider population, entranced, if I can steal a line from Derek, by their electronic hallucinations, is totally unprepared for. And the state, if you've watched, has passed a series of draconian laws, essentially stripping us by judicial fiat of our constitutional rights, to the extent that, and somebody was very right the other day about the Constitution being an anti-democratic document. As some of you know, I sued the president in federal court over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, and much to the surprise of the president, I won. This act it overturns over 150 years of domestic law, permits the military to carry out domestic policing on American streets to seize people who are deemed to substantially support. That's not material support. That's not a legal term. Substantially support Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called associated forces, whatever that is, strip them of due process and hold them until, quote-unquote, the end of hostilities, which in an age of permanent war is forever, in military facilities, including in our offshore penal colonies. We have seen the inability on the courts to respond to wholesale surveillance, which, of course, is an egregious violation of our right to privacy, and, I speak as a former investigative journalist, makes investigative journalism into the centers of power impossible. Because if they can trace your sources, which they can, they shut them down, which is why Snowden fled the country, because he understood. So there is no ability now to essentially shine a light into the inner workings of power because of mass surveillance, which is very dangerous. Because the crimes of state, number one, will never be exposed. And because of a dysfunctioning judiciary, which has become a wholly owned subsidiary of the corporate state, even when they are exposed, as Snowden exposed them, there's no response. Nobody is protecting us anymore. And we have undergone, and I don't have time, and I urge you all to read Sheldon Wolin's great book, Democracy Incorporated, Our Greatest Living Political Philosopher. He's 92. I just did a 8-part interview with him. You can watch on the Real News. But he describes the system we live under as inverted totalitarianism, in that it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression in a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but in the anonymity of the corporate state. That in inverted totalitarianism, you have a reactionary or a revolutionary force that overthrows a structure. In inverted totalitarianism, you have a structure that purports to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography, the language of American patriotism, and yet internally has seized all of the levers of power. And that's where we are, which means that we must go back to the radicalism of mass movements, which stood in perpetual opposition to power. And the next book, which will be out in the spring, is called Wages of Rebellion. And it argues, and I think, again, this is something that we all know how bad it is. And yet, resistance is a moral imperative. I don't fight fascists because I'm going to win. I fight fascists because they're fascists. And we're going to have to recover that ethic, which indigenous communities, Crazy Horse, Sitting Bull, understood. Resistance is a way to affirm life, even in the face of what Freud would call the Thanatos instinct or the death instinct, which is what is propelling global capitalism and endless war or superpower, which is the face of global capitalism. I want to close by reading a short section from Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, when Cornel West and I held a people's hearing of Goldman Sachs in Zuccotti Park, and then we marched on Goldman Sachs. Faces appeared to me, moments before protesters from Occupy Wall Street and I were arrested on a windy November afternoon in front of Goldman Sachs. They were not the faces of the smug Goldman Sachs employees who peered at us through the revolving doors and lobby windows. They were not the faces of the blue uniform police with their dangling plastic handcuffs, or the thuggish Goldman Sachs security personnel whose buzz cuts and dead eyes reminded me of the Stasi. They were not the faces of the demonstrators around me, the ones with massive student debts and no jobs, the ones weighed down by their broken dreams, the ones whose anger and betrayal triggered the street demonstrations and occupations for justice. They were not the faces of the onlookers, the construction workers who seemed cheered by the march on Goldman Sachs, or the suited businessmen who did not. They were faraway faces. They were the faces of children dying. They were tiny, confused, bewildered faces I had seen in the southern Sudan, Gaza, the slums of Brazzaville, Nairobi, Cairo, Delhi, and the wars I covered. They were faces with large, glassy eyes above bloated bellies. They were the small faces of children convulsed by the ravages of starvation and disease. I carry these faces. They do not leave me. I look at my own children and cannot forget them, these other children who never had a chance. War brings with it a host of horrors, but the worst is the human detritus that war and famine leave behind, the small, frail bodies whose tangled limbs and vacant eyes condemn us all. The wealthy and the powerful, the ones behind the glass at Goldman Sachs, laughed and snapped pictures of us as if we were an odd lunchtime diversion from commodities trading, from hoarding and profit, from the collective sickness of money worship, as if we were creatures in a cage, which in fact we soon were. Goldman Sachs Commodities Index is the most heavily traded in the world. The financial firm hoards futures of rice, wheat, corn, sugar, and livestock, and jacks up commodity prices by as much as 200% on the global market, so that poor families can no longer afford basic staples and literally starve. Hundreds of millions of poor in Africa, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America do not have enough to eat in order to feed this mania for profit. The technical jargon learned in business schools and on trading floors effectively masks the reality of what is happening: murder. The cold, neutral words of business and commerce are designed to make systems operate, even systems of death, with a ruthless efficiency. The people behind the windows and those of us with arms locked in a circle on the concrete outside do not speak the same language. Profit, trade, speculation, globalization, war, national security. These are the words they use to justify the snuffing out of tiny lives, acts of radical evil. The glass tower before us is filled with people carefully selected for the polish and self-assurance that comes with having been formed in institutions of privilege. And their primary attributes are a lack of consciousness, a penchant for deception, aggressiveness, a worship of money, and an incapacity for empathy or remorse. And it is always the respectable classes, the polished Ivy League graduates, the prep school boys and girls who are the most susceptible to evil. To be intelligent, as some are, at least in a narrow analytical way, is morally neutral. These respectable citizens are inculcated in their elitist ghettos with values and norms, including pious acts of charity used to justify their privilege, and a belief in the innate goodness of American power. They are trained to pay deference to systems of authority. They are taught to believe in their own goodness and are unable to see or comprehend, and perhaps are indifferent to, the cruelty inflicted on others by the exclusive systems they serve. And as norms change, as the world is steadily transformed by corporate forces into a small cobble of predators and a vast herd of human prey, these elites seamlessly replace one set of values with another. These elites obey the rules. They make the system work, and they are rewarded for this. In return, they do not question. We seem to have lost, at least until the advent of the Occupy movement, not only all personal responsibility, but all capacity for personal judgment. Corporate culture absolves all of responsibility. This is part of its appeal. It relieves all from moral choice. There is an unequivocal acceptance of principles such as unregulated capitalism and globalization as a kind of natural law. The steady march of corporate capitalism requires a passive acceptance of new laws and demolished regulations, of bailouts in the trillions of dollars and the systematic looting of public funds, of lies and deceit. The corporate culture epitomized by Goldman Sachs has seeped into our classrooms, our newsrooms, our entertainment systems, and our consciousness. The corporate culture has stripped us of the right to express ourselves outside of the narrow confines of the established political order. We are forced to surrender our voice. Corporate culture serves a faceless system. It is, as Hannah Arendt wrote, the rule of nobody. And for this very reason, perhaps the least human and most cruel form of rulership. Those who resist, the doubters, outcasts, artists, renegades, skeptics, and rebels, do not come from the elite. They ask different questions. They seek something else, a life of meaning. They have grasped Immanuel Kant's dictum: if justice perishes, human life on earth has lost its meaning. And in their search, they come to the conclusion that, as Socrates said, it is better to suffer wrong than to do wrong. This conclusion makes a leap into the moral. It refuses to place a monetary value on human life. It acknowledges human life, indeed all life, as sacred. And this is why, as Arendt points out, the only morally reliable people are not those who say this is wrong or this should not be done, but those who say I can't. The greatest evildoers are those who don't remember because they have never given thought to the matter. And without remembrance, nothing can hold them back, Arendt wrote. For human beings, thinking of past matters means moving in the dimension of depth. striking roots and thus stabilizing ourselves so as not to be swept away by whatever may occur, the zeitgeist or history or simple temptation. The greatest evil is not radical. It has no roots. And because it has no roots, it has no limitations. It can go to unthinkable extremes and sweep over the whole world. There are streaks in my lungs, traces of the tuberculosis I picked up around hundreds of dying Sudanese during the famine I covered as a foreign correspondent. I was strong and privileged and fought off the disease. They were not and did not. The bodies, most of them children, were dumped into hastily dug mass graves. The scars I carry within me are the whispers of these dead. They are the faint marks of those who never had a chance to become men or women, to fall in love, and have children of their own. I carried these scars to the doors of Goldman Sachs. I placed myself at the feet of these commodity traders to call for justice, because the dead and those dying in slums and refugee camps across the planet could not make the journey. I see their faces. They haunt me in the day and come to me in the dark. They force me to remember, and they make me choose sides. Thank you.
Can we get another round of applause for Chris Hedges? There aren't very many people who can hold a crowd like him. Okay, so raise your hand if you all were here yesterday. Who came to day one of the conference? Wow, we've got a lot of returnees. Good, good. If you were not here yesterday, you are in for an absolute treat. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce to you Dominique Christina. Again, those of you who weren't here, that applause should let you know what you're in for. Dominique Christina is a writer, she's a performer, an educator, and an activist. She holds 4 national titles in the 3 years she's been competing in slam poetry, including the 2012 and 2014 Women of the World Slam Champion, and 2011 National Poetry Slam Champion. She is presently the only person to have held 2 national titles at one time and the only poet in history to win the Women of the World Poetry Championship twice. Woo-hoo! A lot of you may not know, but she is a former 1996 Olympic volleyball player as well. And she has 10 years' experience as a licensed teacher, holding a double master's degree in education and English literature. Prepare yourselves for the indomitable Dominique Christina.
When I came in today, I spoke briefly with Sava, and I was telling her about my family of origin. I come from, I always say they're impossibly possible people. My family matriculated from Little Rock, Arkansas, to Denver, Colorado, which is where I was born and raised. My aunt was one of 9 students to desegregate Central High School. And it's impressive, I suppose. And she has a Congressional Medal of Honor and all of these formal head nods for what she did, right? And her willingness to walk every single day through a hissing mob with paratroopers there to protect her from the car door to the front door. But once she was inside, whatever she negotiated was something that she would have to swallow. And she could not respond in any way. Those students were told they were absolutely not allowed to respond. It's complicated history for me. As a little girl, I inherited those stories. And in many respects, it didn't compute. Because they were seismic and large, my family, you know? But they swallowed so much shit in the name of what, progress. It's very dizzying and discombobulating for me. The writer that I am, the poet that I am, the mother that I am, and the person that I am, I feel, is absolutely the product of the family in which I was raised, because though noble and regal, and they've done amazing things, they never showed up in anger. Never, not once. My grandfather was in the segregated company of the Army in World War II. He was in the Negro Leagues. He's in the Negro League Hall of Fame. He was a shortstop for the Kansas City Monarch. When he left, Jackie Robinson took his place. Jackie Robinson is my mother's godfather. That's why she's named Jackie. I mean, it's a lot of history. There were 2 stories that I inherited specifically, and these 2 poems that I'm going to share with you are born out of that. And ironically, they didn't have anything to do with my family's specific trauma. The first I'm going to tell you, it's not, these poems aren't happening in order of how they occurred in history. It's just how I can hold it. The first story is the story of the bombing of the Birmingham Baptist Church, the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963, September 1963. Where sticks of dynamite were planted under the steps of the church, because the church was a meeting place. This is where subversive activities happened. This is where you figured out if you were going to march and for how long and what the boycotts would look like, right? And those sticks of dynamite detonated just as Sunday school had gotten underway. There were 26 young people in Sunday school in the basement of that church. All of them were maimed. 4 of them were killed, 4 little girls. My mother told me this story when I was young. And I never forgot it. So this poem is for the 4 little girls who died in the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. This is Birmingham Sunday. You know, I don't know what came down first. A church isn't made for falling in on itself. You don't build them prepared for destruction. You build them thinking about the praise shout or the hand clap, the open-mouthed communion, how many choir members can fit in the pulpit, the pancake breakfast you'll have in the basement, and the stained glass Jesus. Even in Birmingham, Alabama, 1963, when you had to account for dynamite, for waterlogged protest marchers blown clean off their feet, they fell like blood-torn right angles to foaming at the mouth police dogs, billy clubs, and batons. If you were a colored girl in Birmingham, you knew how to duck and shrink, how to be a misspelled word, squelched down to sugar-softened press and curl perkiness. Their silence was so loud, their teeth a locked gate,
Their mouths held annual sit-ins for their flame-red throats. The sizzle and spill of every unsaid thing. And it's hard to be that still. With all that starshine and playground shimmy in the stretch of their bones. But on Sundays, they got it near right. The mornings rolled out in hotcakes and black coffee. Daddy was a baritone down the hall singing hymns. Mama was fixing his tie and yelling about, get in here and eat before this food gets cold. And they got to wear their hair down. It would be curled around their ears and stopped with ribbon. And the wild hunger of Jim Crow can't find you in church. So you're scooting around in the kitchen in your pretty white shoes. And your sister gets to dab a little rouge on her cheeks. Just on Sundays, though. Just on Sundays. And the car ride is a sovereign, floating joy. Because your mama can sing, and she's rolling that pretty bell-tinkle soprano out, and you're picking up the chorus where you can, and though you have to keep tugging at your slip so that it does not dip below your dress, you are still everything new and shiny that God has ever loved, and deep and high in your sometime colored girl loveliness, because Jim Crow does not seek you in church. I don't know what came down first, but when the choir was singing, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free, and you were a wet giggle with your sister in Sunday school, the sky came down and smothered everything. Ceiling tiles flew like occasional birds, smacked the walls and smoldered, skulls and incandescent smoke, a wild death for a young girl, a valley of broken jawbone, baby teeth scattered like confetti, a stony, vexing sleep. The sun, crazy, was shining anyway. Refugee clergy digging through the rubble, finding tiny limbs, and the world was a singed skirt. I don't know what came down first, but it all came down, didn't it, Addie and Denise? Didn't it, Cynthia? Didn't it, Carol? Didn't it drop winter in? Didn't it catch and keep the sky snatched low by the terrible clanging of dynamite? Nobody should offer you a heaven when you hadn't even had your period yet, or been to your first dance, or had the chance to gossip about it the next day. And nobody can refresh your bones. Your mother will never be the woman who can smile with all her teeth, because somebody lifted a sheet and underneath it was your bomb blasted body, and the world broke open and swallowed her whole. Things fall apart. Center will not hold. But do you hear that? Just over all that ugly, do you hear that? Past the thundercrack of grief and go down Moses, do you hear that? No homemade detonated bomb can touch it, because just down the street, there's still rough and tumble tag. And tea parties. Some little girl is still lemon cookie, hula hoop, and hopscotch wonderful, twirling around in her mother's old stitched and restitched skirts. And she'll go to church, ironically, on Sunday, singing, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. And she'll mean it.
So for this last poem, I barely read this anymore because it's just painful. The other story that I inherited that sat in my body like war from the moment I heard it till now, right now, it's persistent, was the story of Emmett Till, a young man born in Chicago His mother, in 1955, Mamie Till, sent him down to the Mississippi Delta to visit relatives. And quite frankly, Emmett did not understand the rules of engagement, Jim Crow, segregation. These are terms. They don't mean anything. And he goes down being 14 and needing to convince his backwoods country-ass cousins that he is worldly. That makes sense to me. I have backwoods country-ass cousins that when I traveled down south, it was important that I convince them that I was far more worldly. And he's down there talking about the white girlfriends he has and this is how y'all live? And something happened. They go to a corner store in Money, Mississippi. And when they're walking out, an attractive woman is walking in. An attractive white woman is walking in, and Emmett whistles at her and says, "Bye, baby." And his cousin is mortified. And based on that reaction, Emmett realizes, maybe for the first time, that there's something here that I have failed to grasp. And they rush home. And that night, after that woman told her husband and brother what happened, her husband and brother came to Emmett's uncle's house, Mose Wright. And they snatched Emmett out of the house. They put him in the back of a pickup truck. They drove him to a barn where he was tortured for hours. His eye was gouged out. His genitals were burned. They beat him and they beat him until they finally put a bullet in his brain, threw the body back into the pickup truck, drove along a road, stopping only to steal a cotton gin that they would use to weigh his body down before throwing it in the Tallahatchie River. Those men, after they were acquitted of Emmett Till's murder, gave an interview with Life magazine where they talked about just what they had done to Emmett Till, and that the only time they felt fear or regret was for stealing that cotton gin because they didn't want to be thought of as thieves. My grandmother, raising my mother in the South, didn't know how to tell my mother about this. So when Jet magazine published the mangled image of Emmett Till on its cover, because Emmett Till's mother decided to have an open funeral with an open casket because she could barely recognize her son herself when she went to identify the body. The only reason why she knew it was her son was because the ring he had on bore his initials, and that's how she knew. If you're not a parent, maybe that's not seismic for you. I am a parent. It's seismic for me. You memorize every detail of your child. You know every part of them. She could not recognize him. So she said, "I want the world to see what happens to my boy." And that image went out, and it was on the cover of Jet magazine, and my grandmother left it for my 8-year-old mother to find because she didn't have language to offer to something like that. And then years later, I'm sitting in my living room watching the documentary of Emmett Till for the billionth time. I always re-enroll in that story, no matter how many times. It wounds me, and my 14-year-old son came walking into the room, entirely integrated and unaware, and I forced him to sit down and watch it. Repeating the legacy. This is Emmett Till. Southern trees bear a strange fruit. In this photo, he's laughing. And there is no cotton gin tied around his waist. He's not stretched into swollen limbs. His eyes are still hazel and recognizable. Two neat white rows of perfect teeth sit totem-like in his mouth. And the world did not know him because he had not been murdered yet. He's still slipping into the kitchen to get another piece of cornbread when his mama's not looking. He's going to mash it with his fingers, drink some buttermilk with it, and smile with those eyes. And they are still hazel and bright, like stars in uppercase. And nobody's gouged him out or shut him closed. And when he goes to school,
He'll do a silly little dance with his arms and legs cocked out at odd angles, and his classmates will laugh, and there will be no cotton gin tied around his waist. Pastoral scenes of the gallant South, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. In this photo, he's proud of the hat on his head. You can see that by how straight his neck is. And his mama's in the picture, and they got the same face. And his hair is high and perfect. And ain't no bullet in it. And it will be months before there is one. And in those months, he is his mother's child. The smug and overfed man-child all Southern ladies love to cook for, because he licks that plate clean. Even if it's leftovers, he just eats. And yes, ma'ams, and makes you giggle so much you have to shoo him out the kitchen just so you can get the pots clean. And he's breathing and whole. And there are no men dressed like midnight, with sunless, unlaughing eyes, snatching him out the door, changing everything when neither he or his mother asked to be anything other than laughing in the kitchen with the greens still simmering in the pot. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. This last photo is a Holocaust. It's the one that history concretized into the nighttime musings of children who hopscotched above and below Bible Belt, who saw a tattered, otherworldly version of the 14-year-old Emmett, head poised strangely above a sharp black suit on the cover of Jet magazine. There were no eyes smiling. Mischievous man-child wonderful. Cornbread and buttermilk slicking. Fast talking, looking like his mama. Straight-necked, full of tomorrow's boy. Staring back into the camera. What was there was not there at all. My mama was 8 years old when they painted Emmett Till's fractured image on the cover of a Negro magazine. 8 years old. Pigtails, pinafores, pleats, and a heap of pretty girl possibilities. And my grandmother, she set that book down with intention on the coffee table, knowing her baby girl would see it and then know what should not be known, but what must be known. This is what they did with an adolescent mistake. When a fast-talking, finger-snapping Negro from up north came down south bragging about big-city white girl honeys with rosy lips and no Jim Crow, it is an image I shoved at my 14-year-old son, frenetic in my attempt to tell him that this is black history. I need him to know. If he's not careful, not brave, not the sum total of all our unlit courage, if he relegates these stories to cliff notes, he bleeds out and dies in the epilogue. I need you to know, Sally, that my arms will never be wide enough to cover sins like these that your head held so high is still a cautionary tale. But go on and do it anyway. Go on and do it anyway, son, and laugh and dance with your arms and legs cocked out at odd angles and slip by me and get the extra cornbread whenever you can and be grateful that when you and your boys say something slick about the pretty blonde girl in the front row of algebra, you are permitted that after 400 years of midnights, necks decorated in nooses, plantations that dressed up terrorism in white lace gloves and mint julep, I tell my son to remember Emmett Till when he was whole, intact, when his neck was straight, wearing that hat proudly. I tell my son to remember that Emmett's mother loved him and almost could not recognize him when that last whistle left his throat. I tell my son, I'm gonna be your mama. All the days of my life, I will celebrate your brown boy buoyancy. And while I do not know what tomorrow holds, I know that you will never be strange fruit. You'll never be broken open. You'll never be strung up, never be hog-tied, never have your face so like my own, crushed, hatcheted, mangled. I tell my son, I'm growing these limbs for you, Sully, to get around you and surround you, and we will be strong and unapologetically black for as long as we can be.